It's time for a solid hour of business insights and strategies for success on Mind Your Business. And here's your host, the president and founder of Bottom Line Marketing, Yitzhak Saflis.
You're tuned to another edition of Mind Your Business right here on 77 WABC in the New York, New Jersey metro area and around the world at WABCBizRadio.com. This show, Mind Your Business, on the legendary 77 WABC, is all about you. Every single week, we interview C-level executives and business leaders from all types of industries and ask them the questions that are on your mind. Gain business advice and strategy on so many industries and professions, including sales, social media, corporate culture, emerging technologies, leadership, strategic planning, retail, entrepreneurship, and so much more. Stay tuned for tonight's edition of Mind Your Business, where you'll gain solid advice and strategies to get you ahead in the business world. As we do each week, we open with some thank yous. Special thank you to Pesach Tropper, the show's producer. Rena, Srilli, Miriam, Dina, and the team here at Bottom Line Marketing Group, thank you. Also, shout out to the great people at 77 WABC, Jose, Matt, Chris, Brian, Justin. Thank you very much. Also, a special thank you to last week's guest, Steve Rizzo, world-renowned comedian and motivational speaker. His interview was fantastic, getting great feedback. The episode is up on the iTunes channel. The easiest way to access his interview and all past episodes is by going to WABCBizRadio.com, WABCBizRadio.com. In fact, that's where you get to hear, I mean, all the episodes. I believe they're close to 70 at this point. The interview we had with Jenna Wolf, Stephen Aldridge, Chief Product Officer at GoDaddy, Josh Moore, General Manager at Uber, Dan Sullivan, President of Strategic Coach, Stephen Sato, former CEO of Saks Fifth Avenue, Dr. Adrian Boise, Chief Experience Officer at the Cleveland Clinic, Joe Hart, President and CEO of Dale Carnegie Training, so many more. They're all available by going to WABCBizRadio.com. Well, let's get right to tonight's guest. It's a very, very special edition. Well, as everyone knows, unless you've been sleeping under a rock somewhere, not even in America, because then you would still know, we just came off a incredible historic moment in the election, the 2016 presidential election, with the culminating in the victory of Donald Trump. We realize that this is an incredible moment to have a special edition where we'll talk about the race, the outcome, and what takeaways there could be. Now, it's true, the makeup of the listenership is primarily small business owners, entrepreneurs, and to medium-sized business owners. That being said, there's a lot of lessons that can be learned, especially from the fact that fundamentally it was an entrepreneur that won the presidentship of the United States of America. I mean, now he's not just an entrepreneur, but that's what it is. So, live in studio, we have none other than Kalman Yeager and Michael Fragan. Just a brief bio about our great guests. Kalman Yeager is a political strategist, primarily in the Democratic line. This is a bipartisan conversation. Okay, I just want to get that out there. And that's Kalman. Michael is a Republican political strategist, primarily Republican. He's also the deputy mayor of Lawrence, also has his own active weekly radio show. I'm going to get right into it. With that, we give a very warm welcome to Kalman. Michael, thank you for joining me here on Mind Your Business.
Thank you. Great to be here. Thanks.
This is going to be an incredible show. Also, I must give a special thank you out at WABC, Rita Cosby, the great work that she's done on the political coverage in this year's election. Well, let's just jump in. You know what? I would want to start by even going back to some of your experience. I go back with both Kalman and Michael many, many years. Michael, I think it was in the 04 Bush race that we got to meet.
Yes. Wait, that's quite some time ago.
Quite some time ago.
Or three elections ago in the in presidential years.
Yeah. And then, of course, in the Michael Bloomberg race in 05.
Right.
And then you were in the Pataki administration.
I was back during those times.
Amazing.
Yes, it feels like a long time since then. My, how the Republican Party
You're
has
not
changed
that old.
In those days. Now that Donald Trump was a New York figure back then, but who back then would have thought that in 2016, certainly not most of the Republican intelligentsia. And I don't know if you can use the word intelligentsia anymore about the political punditry class, because if people are out there telling you that they got it right,
They're lying.
I don't like to use the word lying on there. That's more of a Democratic term, at least in this race. But yes, they're lying.
Well, actually, I think your candidate or your party's candidate was the first one who coined the term lying as a
lion
related
Ted.
Lion Ted. That's right. So, you know, I'm not sure that Democrats are the ones who often sling the accusations of lies, but it is true, Michael. There is nobody who can honestly tell you that they called this. There are people who felt one way or another, but, you know, nobody woke up Tuesday morning and said, when I go to sleep at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, Donald Trump is going to be president-elect.
Went to sleep on Monday night. There were plenty of people who went to sleep on Tuesday night. Trump's victory was apparent by
8 o'clock or so that he was on the track towards it.
Right.
Certainly. There were a couple bellwethers for me when I started hearing the returns, and it was election day. So I was working. I had candidates that I was working for. I was actively involved in races. And remember, New York closes at 9 p.m., mm-hmm. but other states start closing at 7, including Florida, which is an important Indiana. When I saw the Senate race in Indiana, which actually was supposed to be a super competitive, hyper-competitive race to replace Evan Bayh, who was a Indiana institution, was running against Todd Young. And it was the conventional wisdom for a long time was that Bayh was going to run away with the seat. It was going to be a Democratic flip. And Young, he didn't just win. He walked away with it. And you started to think, okay, there is a chance here that the Republican vote's coming out and the Democratic vote is not coming out, and really just not coming out at all, because that was supposed to be a neck and neck race. And that ended up being, I mean, just a unbelievably, well, not, I mean, it was a 10-point race. So that was very surprising. So once that happened, and then they didn't call Florida right away, and nobody's paying attention. Right. You know, you're not paying attention to the fact that they're not calling Florida, but everybody said, what time is this race going to be over?
Well, they started talking about Florida in confusing ways. They started saying, we don't know. And once they start, you know, when they start saying we don't know and Florida in the same sentence, you start to perk up, because Florida is where it's been at the last two out of the last three elections that, you know, it turned in some sense, certainly in 2000, it turned in every sense towards Florida. But when they started saying we don't know, that meant that Hillary's votes in Florida were not strong enough to make it certain at the early hours. And that put Florida into play. Once Florida was in play, Trump had a path. If Florida was not in play for him, he had no path as of at least Monday night when we all went to sleep and woke up Tuesday morning.
Right. So the key really for Florida is two things. Is the reporting of the early vote and the huge Hispanic turnout.
Right. That allegedly.
In the early vote. Well,
in the early vote, sure.
In the early vote, very significant turnout in Miami-Dade County. It turns out Hillary did turn out her vote in Miami-Dade County. The Democrats did turn out there, and that actually existed. But Florida, and political junkies know this, Florida has two time zones. So the polls close in Florida at 7.
Right.
But the panhandle actually doesn't close until 8.
And therefore the reporting.
And panhandle is reliably Republican, not just a little bit Republican, but about as red an area. The panhandle is the Deep South. And if you don't win, if you're a Democrat and you're waiting for the panhandle to come in because to call it, you know you're in trouble on that. I worked in Florida. I'm very familiar with the state and how it comes in. And it was certainly, you know, they were waiting for Broward County to kind of come in. They were slow to report. They kept waiting for Broward County. Is Broward County going to have enough? Is Broward County going to have enough votes in order to turn this back? And at no point did that actually happen. But the real message, I don't want to jump ahead here, but just my thesis with regard to this election is Florida is actually the one anomaly in the swing state race here. Florida had more votes by a lot in 2016 than were voted in 2012, which is actually surprising. The other big states actually had fewer votes altogether. Clinton had more votes in Florida than did Obama in 2012, and Trump had more votes in Florida than did Mitt Romney in 2012. Mm. Actually, that Trump had 442,000 more votes in there, and Clinton had 367,000 more votes in there. So Florida was actually actively contested. That's a case where both both parties got their vote out in Florida, as opposed to some of the other states.
Right. Both candidates had been down there, dozens of times in the last 2-3 months, and were really working hard. And certainly, Clinton campaign was sending surrogates down there. The Trump campaign was working very hard. There was an active Senate race there that had to have helped a little bit, at least, with Rubio getting back into it. I don't know what would have happened if it wasn't Rubio at the top of the ticket, or relatively speaking, at the top of the ticket for the Republicans in Florida, and
now,
if it was an unknown person.
Well, it's interesting you say top of the ticket, because Rubio outperformed Trump.
Right,
quite
that's
a bit.
Correct. And that was very – I believe that to have been important for Trump, to have a very popular incumbent on the ballot in Florida. Latino.
Yeah. Great point. I do want to also get to Pennsylvania, because obviously there's a lot to talk about. But first, let me just talk about some general general look back at the race. And again, feel free to answer in any which way you wish. The media. Now, to us in the room, it's obvious there was a bias. But I'll just ask the question this way. Do you feel that... I'll ask. It's such a dumb question.
No dumb questions.
Only dumb
answers.
Was there a media bias against Donald Trump?
I'll take this first, okay. Michael. I mean, I believe there was a media bias in the broad sense, but I think it's a vicious cycle when it comes to a media bias, because I think that it worked in a very circular fashion. The media bias was a response by the media to the way Trump was treating the media, which turned into a bias against Trump, which exasperated the reaction, which turned the bias even stronger, to the point where
it spiraled.
And so a lot of what, when Trump would say something that was demonstrably untrue, and I think everybody at this table, including a Republican, can admit that a lot of what Trump was saying was demonstrably not true. And then the media would debate amongst themselves, well, are we allowed to call him a liar? We're reporters. We're supposed to be independent. But if we know something's not true, can we call him a liar? So then they run, let's pick the New York Times. They run a front, top of the fold, front page story that goes into and takes a full broadsheet on Donald Trump not being truthful about pick your issue. And then Trump says, well, that's a completely unfair story. You are crooked media. You're liars. Well, okay. Well, what do you think the reporters are going to do then? Well, you the liar calling me a liar, we're going to call you back a liar. So there absolutely was a bias, but it was circular. It was institutional. It was across the board. I don't necessarily believe it was an unfair bias, though. I believe there was a bias that you just see. On the other hand, when we talk about the media, it's not just the New York Times, NBC, but the media includes the Breitbarts. The media includes the Huffington Post, which is biased in a different direction.
Right. News
the
Max,
media
Fox.
Is a lot, and certainly Fox, certainly CNN, certainly MSNBC. So you have a lot of media that's not your standard New York Times reporter with credentials around their neck, but even beyond the cable TV news media, you have a lot of the web-based media, the Breitbarts, which is clearly a biased media. You have Drudge Report. That's media. That's a very biased media. So there's a lot of media that was biased in favor of Trump. Does it balance out? I'm not a mathematician when it comes to these things, but I do believe that the bias was in both directions, and certainly it doesn't appear that it hurt Trump at the end.
Oh, I'm going to get to that. But first, Michael, do you want to touch on
that? I'll make 3 points on that. I'll try and make them very succinctly so we can get to the next point here, is that I think the media was biased towards Trump during the primary. He got far and away more coverage than any nominee of any party could have gotten in any contest.
Okay.
He dominated the airwaves over and over. Partly that's because he's very good at the media. He's very good at getting covered. But he did that. And some of the network executives admitted and they conceded about the fact that they covered him because of ratings and because he was good coverage.
Right.
Number two is that Trump in the general election really had not been oppo researched. The other Republican candidates inexplicably, and I can't figure this out, they just – one of the first things I do as a political professional is Kama does also. You're running in a race. You do two types of oppo research. You do it on your own candidate, and then you do it on the other guy or the other people that you're running against. Nobody did it on Trump. All the stories that came out during the general election probably should have come out during the primary. It's inexplicable that didn't happen, and the media didn't do any of that. They didn't do any of those stories. They didn't do on the taxes. They didn't do anything. I mean, there's all kinds of things that you could – the Cuba thing. I mean, there's all kinds of things that could have gone out. And as Colin said, none of it mattered. And that gets me to my third point, okay. is as Stephen Colbert back in the old days when he was still with Jon Stewart is called truthiness. And that's kind of what we have now in our political discourse. We're in a state of truthiness, that there really isn't one truth. There's the truth as the elites in Washington, New York, L.A., and on the two coasts see it. And then there's the truth as a lot of other Americans see it. And it's a little bit difficult to have a debate around when things are just truthy as opposed to true, because you don't really know. And as political professionals, it's a difficult landscape to deal with, because you don't know what people are actually going to believe in the end. I think I will tell you, even if, since we both deal a lot with the Orthodox community, truthiness is a real problem with a lot of people, because there is such a tendency to believe every single WhatsApp what message that you get. And people just, well, immediately they've already forwarded it to 30,000 people, and everybody believes, of course, that's exactly what happened. So it's really quite incredible when that happens, but that is the landscape. So overall, is there a bias? Look, everybody has biases. I don't believe that your average reporter working for the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or very well-vetted Washington Post is out there to get a certain candidate. What I believe is they're out there to get every candidate. Every reporter wants a scoop. Everybody wants to get something that nobody else has. And therefore, that's how they work.
Okay.
Well, that's definitely true. I mean, I want to go back to the primary for a second, because, you know, you're right. There was an incredible amount of coverage. And the truth is that if Donald Trump had to pay for the coverage, candidates
said, it was over $2
billion.
And it's phenomenal because, you know,
because he spent almost no money on the primary.
He spent almost no money in the primary. And so when we talk about, you know, doing racism, we talk about free media and, earned media and paid media. And Donald Trump got all earned media. Why? Right. A lot of it had to do with the fact that most in the media didn't believe he would ever move past the first state or two, or even if he would get there. So it was really, you know, the equivalent of rubbernecking on a highway, a really bad accident. You know, you can't turn your eye away. You want to, you have to, because you got to keep going straight, but you got to see what just happened. And Donald Trump guaranteed one thing at every one of his rallies.
Entertainment
factor, absolutely. Yeah. He guaranteed a show. He was going to say something
we call that
nuts.
Ratings.
We call it ratings.
Right.
He was going to say
and
something crazy. He was going to say something nuts, and it was going to get coverage, and he was on the news every night. And he was clearly talking to a part of America when he was doing that, and the rest of America saying, this guy's going nowhere.
And when he's on the news, that means somebody else
is not
on the news. Right. And that's what Scott Walker found immediately. That's what Rick Perry found immediately. These guys just get – there was no oxygen left for them to do. And that happened in the debates also, because they have this ridiculous debate rule, which I think it just defies any logic, that if your name gets mentioned by the other candidate, you are entitled to a response, 30 seconds. So if you only have an hour and you have 10 candidates to begin with, and everybody has to be able to respond to the first guy, how many questions are you going to get?
And
to
if
ask?
they're all mentioning Trump, he's going to respond
Every
to everybody.
Time.
Right.
So it just Well, that makes it, but that is indicative. That's not media bias against Trump. That's media bias for Trump.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the reality is putting 17 candidates on a stage or whatnot during the Republican primaries was guaranteed chaos, and that's what the party got. And it's not, you know, it's not limited to Republicans. It just happened to be limited to Republicans this time.
Let me ask you this question.
Sure.
If Twitter did not exist, would Trump have won?
You know, look.
And obviously, you could say, okay, well, it's Facebook, but you get the gist of the question.
If Texas didn't exist, would Trump have won? I mean, the reality is that Twitter does exist. It's hard to look at this election in the light of not having social media, of not having a Donald Trump
or
on Twitter.
Or any election.
Or any election, yeah. I mean, I remember elections when Twitter was first coming out, and I was one of the, you know, I'm not going to say that I said Twitter's just a fad, it'll pass, but I was a professional in politics, you want to control the message very carefully, and you can't when you have a candidate who has a BlackBerry or an iPhone and is tweeting random thoughts. And so you say, no, we're not going to be on Twitter. And that was sustainable, sure, in 09 and 10 and 11. But at some point, it became an unsustainable thought that you could run a campaign and not be on Twitter. 12, 13, 14, today we're now in 16 and moving into 17. Yeah. You can't not be on Twitter. You have to be able to control your candidate. But the reality is that not controlling Donald Trump didn't seem to hurt him.
Well, it did at certain times. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. The the damage that what the most damage that was done to Donald Trump during the campaign was by Donald Trump.
Always.
Nobody else was able to really lay a very good hand on him, but he was able to do it to himself, which, yeah, we haven't gotten into the conclusion of the campaign as far as that. But that I believe that he did inflict damage on himself. There's no question that, you know, he was able at the end to change the election from a referendum on him to a referendum on Hillary. But there were times that the campaign looked like he was headed to the dustbin of history.
Well, that's the uniqueness about this election is that both candidates' worst opponent in this election was themselves.
Correct.
Absolutely.
Correct.
I mean, Hillary Clinton's problems were all self-inflicted. It was a decision she made in 2008 when she decided she was going to put a server in her house and have her own emails there. It was a conscious decision that was designed based on the fact that I do not want the world to see the emails that I have and that I'm exchanging with people, so I'm going to go about this process. And she paid the price for that through a very painful year and concluding with what happened on Tuesday.
And then couldn't adjust to a world where that was a problem. I mean, the Clintons always had this idea that, or they continued to have this, can't explain. But the Clintons had this idea that the rules don't apply to them. You know, so if I do something, it doesn't matter because there might be somebody else. But even if nobody else has done it, it doesn't matter because, you know, I'll get paid. But she never really has an answer. She hadn't had an answer, and she continues not to have an answer for the email server, other than I'm sorry I did it, I was wrong, but never really accepting the idea that not only was it wrong, but it might have actually endangered national security. It might have been illegal. I mean, there are all kinds of something is not necessarily illegal and automatically you go to jail. There are degrees of illegality. And you never got the sense that she was really willing to deal with it until we got the WikiLeaks emails. And then we saw that there were people on her staff who actually said, and in the campaign, are you serious? Are you kidding me? Did this really happen?
And by the time she conceded the point that it was a wrong decision, it was after America had already decided that it was
tortured.
A bad decision.
Yeah.
So she agreed with what America had already decided, that this was a very bad thing she did. And she got to the point where she said, yes, America, you're right. I made a mistake. That didn't change the narrative because at that point people had already fixed in their minds, well, is she crooked, Hillary? I mean, who is this person? Why are they doing this? And then it goes back to everything we lived through in the 90s with all the Clinton. You couldn't get a day without a Clinton-related scandal. And, you know, that affected Al Gore. I mean, it's interesting, you know, when you look at this election and the 2000 election, both Democrats are people who really should have won. Right. And, you know,
who did win. Right.
And when you look at Al Gore and he lost that election, you look at Hillary, that she lost this election. These were surprise elections, whereas Obama versus Romney, probably not that much of a surprise. Obama versus McCain, not a surprise. Right. Bush Kerry, not a surprise. Clinton Dole, not a surprise. Clinton Bush, not that much of a surprise. But Gore, Bush and Hillary, Trump were huge surprises. And it just turned into a not giving a third term to another Clinton. We don't want to see this in the paper every day.
Well, the numbers bear that out. Clinton got 6 million fewer votes in 2016 than Obama got in 2012. And if you look at the swing states, if Obama was running against, obviously that's not a straight up comparison, but Obama's numbers in 2012 would have beaten Trump in Wisconsin, would have beaten more than 200,000 votes, in Michigan by 285,000 votes, in Pennsylvania by 77,000 votes, Nevada they won Nevada in the end. Okay, Florida, that's the one state, that's the one anomaly out there. In Ohio by 55,000 votes, and New Hampshire by 24,000 votes. So all those states, the map would look totally differently if she would have just come close to Obama, she would be president. But she couldn't. They couldn't do it. They really just underperformed. She underperformed as a candidate. And once the smartest thing that they did, not just in taking Donald Trump's Twitter away for the last 10 days of the campaign, but they just focused relentlessly on Hillary Clinton. They made it about Hillary Clinton, the corruption, the Clinton Foundation, the emails over and over and over. That's what Jim Comey's announcement and then even the retraction did. It focused it on Hillary. And whoever the spotlight was focused on in this election immediately did poorly. But it wasn't just
that's a rule about every election.
Last point. In my mind, that people went over to Trump. It's that people did not come out to vote for Clinton. The Clinton voters, at least a small percentage of them, but enough of a percentage to make a difference, did not come out to vote for her. They just said, we've had enough. We don't want another 4 years of Clinton. We just don't want it. We're done with them. Goodbye.
The one thing that Trump managed to do, which is traditional when it comes to politics, is turn the spotlight, as Michael said, on the other candidate. Right. Anytime you have a campaign where you can get people talking about what's wrong with your opponent versus even what's good about you, that's good. You want people to talk about what's good about you, but if you can get them to talk about what's bad about your opponent, you're winning that day.
Amazing. You're tuned to a special edition of Mind Your Business right here on 77 WABC. My guests in studio are Michael Fragan and Kalman Yeager. We're going to take a short commercial break. Stay tuned.
Your company website is crucial to your success, providing information about your company to the entire world. Was your website recently updated? Is it mobile friendly? And does it have the 2016 look? Well, look no further than WebsiteWithBrains.com, the complete website solution. Call Website with Brains today at 718-412-3500. That's 718-412-3500. Or visit WebsiteWithBrains.com.
And we're back, the Mind Your Business Show, right here on 77 WABC. My guests this evening are none other than Michael Fragan and Kalman Yeager. It's not intentionally designed as a Republican and a Democrat. They both, Michael in general is a Republican guy. Kalman in general is a Democratic guy. We all have a very good mutual friend, Councilman David Greenfield, and certainly he deserves a very big shout-out.
A Democrat, I should point out.
And that. A Democrat, true. Yes.
A race that we both worked on together.
Together.
Yes.
I brought Michael over to the party for a bit.
If you have the conservative line, I can do that. That's the way it works.
We got to talk about polling. And even the New York Times story, where did we go wrong? I mean—
Well, to be clear, we didn't go wrong. We're not pollsters.
No, I went wrong. I'll admit that. I mean, I'm out there saying that I did not think that Donald Trump had a path to victory. I have no problem.
But we based it on other people's polling, not on our own.
No, I based it overall on the dynamics of the Electoral College and historical, you know, data that I had seen. It was an amalgamation of lots of other people's polling. It's an unusual situation where all the polls are wrong in sync with each other, but not just the national polls, but also the state-by-state polls. But you also, and I think we both know, even in hyperlocal races, but you see this, we also know that there are times that the people you expect to come out to vote just don't show up.
It absolutely happens. I mean, for this to happen in such a regular way, though, throughout the entire election, the entire general from Labor Day until now, every poll saying the same thing, not just the national polls, but the state-by-state polls, saying that this is who's going to come out, this is what they're going to do, and that's why we think that there's no path to victory for Donald Trump.
You know that my friends know this. I've been asked at meetings. I don't have the experience that you have, but I certainly have been out there in the political world. I actually had called. I had said a few months ago already, I thought Trump would win, and
so did Michael Moore. So
okay, yeah, and I saw that, and because in my mind it was I viewed the media as being so anti-Trump that they would sometimes bend the way they presented their polling data. So I believe that there was maybe 3-5% that he would really show better than a poll. If the poll was 10% difference, no way. If it was 4%, I'm like, that's really a tie. Even though it's a statistical dead heat and all that, but it really is because they're suppressing some data because they hate him so much. That was one, and also because I was in the room by the Bob Turner race. Now, of course, that's totally different. But I remember every expert telling me, "Say, Weppern will win. You know that." Turner does not have a chance.
But that's a great example. And
Because I lived through it.
That's a great example of a turnout issue. That's a turnout issue. The polling probably was right when you called people. That was actually the responses that they gave. That was a turnout issue. Ultimately, when it came down to it, everybody assumed that based on the polls that we had, you would get this and this many voters because you'll take a percentage of Democrats that are voting for David Weppern. You take a percentage of Republicans that are voting for Bob Turner. You take a percentage of Democrats voting for – you add those all together based on historical turnout models – and therefore, you get the data about how many voters are coming out. If you're a political professional, you have what's known as a bogey. That is the number of votes that you need to win the race. And you put all the data in together and you say, we can get to this many voters in order to do that. Now, for whatever reason, the Republicans, actually the RNC, I mean, there's an article about this. So it's like the RNC showed their turnout models to, they showed them to the media the day before the election. Right. I think, and they were actually right about the number of voters they were going to get. They were just, everybody was wrong about the number of voters that the coming out, the Democrats were going to get. I mean, when you have cities like Milwaukee underperforming by 30% for Clinton, you just can't win if you're a Democrat in that. Now, that hasn't happened vis-a-vis the city versus the rural areas in a state like Wisconsin since 1984.
So what do you attribute the drop in Hillary voters in places where it mattered to, if not Trump beating her up?
Well, I was going to also say the exit polls actually were kind of on. It wasn't the exit polls were wrong, and they also confirmed a lot of things about the data. The only thing they were wrong about, it seems, was college-educated women. College-educated women were expected that Trump was going to have 30 points down. He ended up being 12 points down, I think, in certain states. But they were right about the roll vote. I mean, you can't – what do I attribute the issue? If you're a Democrat, you got to be worried that the – you have to be worried about two things. When do Democrats win the election? When they appeal beyond their base, when they appeal beyond the suburban, the minorities, when they feel they have to appeal to the white working class. That's always been Democratic territory, and they gave up on it this time.
Obama didn't.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Obama, if you look at his numbers, Obama versus Romney, and like if you look
I'm
at
not talking about 12. I'm talking about 8 the first time.
No, I'm talking about Michigan. Even in Michigan. I mean, I think Obama got like 40%.
In 8?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a 30, 40%. Clinton got 20% of these voters. So here, I mean, she just absolutely got creamed amongst white working class voters.
Here's my
question.
And we
knew that was going to happen. But she didn't have any ability to counter it, meaning that you have to have people on your side who are coming out to vote, and she didn't have that.
You answered it well, but now we know we have a new fact. It's a new day in America. We know what the results were. Going forward, how could polling be? I mean, because obviously polling now is considered like, okay, so what good was all the data? It was wrong. Is there a way to say, okay, but we'd have to add now, and just as long as you factor in A, B, and C overlay, it could still make sense.
It's the interpretation that's wrong.
Right. I mean,
the data itself, the data is not wrong.
Right, I mean, data is correct, but I'm saying, but it didn't translate.
When you use polling data, what you're pulling is historical facts. You can't make up information. You have to use historical facts. It's about how you turn that historical fact into what is happening right now. So if I want to take data from 4 years ago or 2 years ago or 6 years ago, and I want to use it in the current year, I have to know why that data has meaning in this current year. What's going on now that means that works? So is my candidate, for example, in Michael's example, is Hillary appealing to the white middle class, to a lower class voter? Is she able to bring that out? You can't use data that said that a Democrat, unnamed, can bring out that voter if Hillary is not doing what she needs to do to close the deal with those voters.
I think the assumption was that Hillary was going to have the Obama coalition. She was going to have younger voters. She underperformed amongst younger voters. She underperformed in the end amongst white suburban women. I mean, women did not gravitate to Hillary Clinton. I think that is the case. The way she needed to. And you could see from her ads that they clearly took whatever data they had and they tried to reinforce that over, because you saw the commercials over and over and over that were directly to appeal to women about Trump's woman problem. And a lot of women were willing to overlook that. Now, that would not be something I would think about. But eventually, that doesn't mean the polling is wrong. Doesn't mean that people don't have that problem. They might think that, okay, I don't like Trump's woman I don't like the things he says to women. That might not translate into a vote. It's very – when you get down and you get this large – when you get this so much data in so many different states, that's the issue. But just to bring it back, I think it was the Times had a very – about the travel schedule, and actually also about Bill Clinton – him pushing Robbie Mook over and over to visit areas that were not part of the Obama areas, but areas that Obama did do, but he did well, that meaning Bill Clinton did well, and meaning central Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. She didn't visit Wisconsin at all. Not once. She lost the state. Now, there is this assumption that a Republican, you know, and you figure, okay, Donald Trump, he did poorly in the primary, put that all together, and therefore 2 + 2 = 4. But, you know, if 2 + 2 actually doesn't equal 4 in the sense that, you know, if 2 + 2 = 22, then you really don't understand what's going on. So they're collecting tons of data that's coming out there, and they just, you know, they just didn't interpret it properly. You know, one place they did was Nevada, however. You know, in Nevada, the Democrats turned out their vote, mostly by Harry Reid, mostly because Latinos, they got the vote out, and that's the one surprise in the Senate race, where Joe Heck was expected to win the Republican, and he lost.
Now, in the time goes very fast in a show like this. There's really some great conversation. We did touch on before Pennsylvania. We know that at the end of the day, that put him over the top at, 2:24 a.m., whatever it was. An interview on Fox with Kellyanne Conway, it was a great perspective put on that. All polling data showed that there was no way he was going to carry Pennsylvania. There was just no way. All the models, everything. But they knew how critical it was, and they kept on going after it. I mean, I love that kind of story. I mean, that's really what all about being an entrepreneur. He just kept and he kept his, and then he sent his wife and everyone. I mean, they pulled out all the stops, and ultimately, one of the many big stories of this election is Pennsylvania. Maybe you could just talk about it. I find that so fascinating.
In an election like this, and in every election, in every presidential election, at the end, it really boils down to a handful of states. So, yes, they did pound on Pennsylvania, also Florida, but they were pounding in places where they had to pound because at the end, when you're talking about 50 states, the electoral math doesn't put 50 states in play. The electoral math puts a handful of them, a very tiny handful of them, Pennsylvania being one of them. And that the demographics of Pennsylvania, you know, obviously Eastern means one thing and Western means something else.
Yeah.
You know, led or not led, but followed the message of Trump, which is that I, this extraordinarily wealthy guy who failed in many, many businesses, but I have a feel, I have an understanding for what it means to be a working class guy because you're getting screwed by your government and I'm going to fix that. That appeals in Pennsylvania. Doesn't matter which candidate's saying it. For the last two cycles, it was Obama saying it in a very clear and coherent way. Now it was Donald Trump saying it. But the other thing I want to say,
that's
why he carried Ohio as well, and that's, by the way, why he carried Wisconsin. I believe, at least
it's a very simple
partially. But I will also say this, you know, I don't want to oversimplify how a presidential campaign ends up, but what you saw here is what you see or what we've seen in America for the last 200 years. It is very, very rare for a party to be succeeded after two terms by a candidate of his own party. It's rare.
Right.
It doesn't
matter
who the candidate is. It just doesn't happen. It doesn't matter how popular it is, the candidate is. And, you know, the rarity of those exceptions are like when Reagan went to Bush, his own vice president. But other than that, you don't find situations like that. So is this really an anomaly? Donald Trump? Yes. You know, a lot of people may think he's a maniac. A lot of people may think he has a great appeal and a great feel for what's going on in the inner workings and lives of your typical American. But at the end, he's the other guy. He's not a continuation of what we've had for 8 years.
Yeah.
And is that...
Well, he's not like anything.
Well,
yeah. that's
fair. That's
but I
fair.
Think that's the case.
Right.
I mean,
right.
it's exactly like that.
They want something different.
If you're happy with the way things are, then you can have another 4 years of Obama, or you want to call it another 4 years of Clinton, because it's the same way that, you know, Bush was viewed by a lot of Republicans in the primary. Do you want the Republicans voter electorate wanted change? They clearly, Bush was not in the zeitgeist of the times. And Clinton campaigns, they should have known that. They should have understood when getting challenged and with a 70-year-old socialist from Brooklyn from Vermont by way of Brooklyn, was able to get tremendous traction against her.
Yeah, that was...
It's just, I think it's a mistake when we think about it now that the Democrats even nominated Hillary Clinton with her liabilities, with her baggage, and knowing that this was a change election. Somebody else should have gotten in. And now Joe Biden tried to get in. Obama pushed him out.
Right.
And that
I'm saying, so Bernie clearly would have won.
I don't think Bernie would have beat Trump.
No way. He would not have beat Trump.
I don't believe that.
I actually think he might have won. I don't think he, I personally, I'm not sure. I think it would have been tough, but there is, you know, there would have been a path to victory, but it's very difficult. I mean, it just doesn't measure up, but Joe Biden would have won.
I think,
you could have had people who would
Joe Biden would not have lost Pennsylvania.
Right.
And Joe Biden would have been able to close the deal in a better way in Florida.
Just remember, if you're looking at, as Colin talked about, historical data, that's critical because you know the voters that came out. You know who voted. You know who voted back in 2012 and who voted in 2008, and you know those people who voted. 2.9 million votes for Obama in Pennsylvania, 2.6 million, so a 300,000 vote margin in 2012. Okay, that doesn't seem everybody's looking at it's a question of how many percentage points are we going to go down from what we did if you would just assume, but Clinton underperformed yet again. If you look at that, she 145,000 votes fewer. That's a huge amount. That's an absolutely huge amount. And most of those are coming from the Philly suburbs.
Right.
So, and Philly itself, that's the Democratic stronghold of the state. And Trump just kept getting and relentlessly pushing that message of, as Colin said, if you're unhappy with the way things have gone in your town here in Wilkes-Barre or in, Altoona or, Altoona, I mean, these places, and if things are not going well for you, then you vote for me. What do you have to lose? And actually, I thought that was a really good
message.
That
was one of his lines, yeah.
What do you have to lose? And the truth is, look, a lot of voters felt they embraced that message. With all the other stuff out there, at their core, they're saying, okay, I know what Clinton's like. I don't know what Trump is like. So therefore, I don't like Clinton, and I'm not going to vote for her.
In the few remaining minutes we have, I want to talk about 2017. I have to ask you a question that I allow you to take a pass on if you wish. You ready?
Go.
Is Michael Bloomberg kicking himself? It's a good question.
It's a good question. I saw a tweet about Michael Bloomberg Tuesday night or Wednesday morning. Is he kicking himself? I don't know, because he would not have been able to get the Republican nomination. That would not have happened. So the question is, what would his path have been, only as a third party candidate? I mean, he couldn't win a Democratic nomination. He couldn't win the Republican nomination. He would have had to come in as a third party candidate. So from whom would he have taken votes? I mean, I don't know that he's kicking himself. I think if he's kicking himself, it's only in the sense that he has a visceral dislike for Donald Trump. I'm not sure where it comes from, but he's probably kicking himself because I think he hates him.
I hear, but I was talking about that, man, I could have gotten the White House.
I don't know if he could have.
That
path is a strange path because he would have literally had to run a third party race across 50 states.
The most I think that a third party candidate can do really is damage is deprive the other candidates of 270.
The Ross Perot factor.
Okay, well, Ross Perot actually did not deprive.
Yeah, Ross Perot
did not win a state. Did not win a single state. The only thing he did is deprive Bush of the election.
Right, I'm saying deprive.
But that's an assumption, of course. Right. You're assuming everybody's saying, okay, Gary Johnson's margin, if you would add Gary Johnson back to Clinton, she would have won all the states. What makes anybody think that Gary Johnson voted?
It depends how close it is. But if you go back to 2000, you could look at Ralph Nader and you could look at a 500 and change vote margin in Florida and say, look, you know, guy got 90,000 votes. 500 of those... that's what we're talking about.
Or some of them could have gone to...
You just don't know.
It's not a good... I mean, the one thing we actually had, which was interesting is that Evan McMullen in Utah, at one point he was polling even with Clinton and Trump. Had he won Utah, and that would have deprived Donald Trump of those votes, then potentially nobody gets 270 that would have gone to the House. But if it goes to the House, Michael Bloomberg isn't getting it.
You're tuned to a special edition of Mind Your Business right here on 77 WABC. In case you're just tuning in, my guests this evening are Michael Fragan and Kalman Yeager, and we're, of course, talking about the 2016 presidential election. In the remaining few minutes, let's talk about local politics. Again, we're here on WABC, a local station. It's the entire New York, New Jersey, Connecticut metro area.
That's local to us.
Yes, certainly a very big part of
all politics is local.
Yeah, that is true. By the way, I digress. How fascinating was it that that both candidates on election night were literally within a one mile radius?
It's just fascinating to think that at the end, obviously they're in some respects, then neither of them are New Yorkers, or in many respects, neither of them are New Yorkers, but they're both New Yorkers.
Yeah.
That's a very weird thing. We haven't seen that in America in a very long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think the choice of the Peninsula Hotel as the after party for Hillary Clinton was a poor one after that being a block away from Trump Tower.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, I'm sure she had to pass. Well,
that?
I'm sure I have no doubt, just like the fireworks that they were canceled by the Clinton campaign, I have no doubt that they had originally intended to win. And there was no question that booking the Peninsula Hotel was the idea of, you know, the after party would include a little, we won, you lost situation.
Yeah. Well, we're about to head into 2017. 2017, big year in New York politics. Everything's in play, basically. Let's talk about mayor. Okay, Bill de Blasio, incumbent. There's investigations. There's a lot going on. First of all, my question is, do you think that he'll get a challenger on the Democratic side?
I think he'll get a challenger. I'm not sure who the challenger will be.
Scott Stringer is making a lot of noise.
Scott Stringer, full disclosure, I do work for Ruben Diaz Jr., who is thinking about it. There are other people who are thinking about it. Hakeem Jeffries, a congressman from Brooklyn, right. Queens. Or players to be named later who we haven't thought of. The system in which you have to run if you're running for mayor of New York is a very complicated and difficult system for, campaign finance-wise to get into. A candidate like Hakeem Jeffries, who I think can raise a lot of money, is a little bit hobbled by the fact that he doesn't already have a committee going where he started to collect those matchable contributions. It's very difficult to get qualified for the matching programs that Scott Stringer and Ruben Diaz Jr. are well on their way to doing. Will all three of them run? You know, I think a lot of that depends on how the mayor functions over the next, 3 to 4 months, and what else, if anything, comes out of these multiple investigations. The very interesting thing that I will note is that, where we assume that Hillary Clinton would win and that Preet Bharara is already ordered up his banker's boxes to stuff his papers in and leave. Donald Trump said a few days ago that he's quite happy happy with the work that he's been doing and intends to keep him. That's not good for crooked politicians in New York, and that's not good for politicians who are under investigation. I don't think there's a single politician who Preet Bharara has set his eyes on to investigate who he has then later said, I don't think he's done anything wrong.
I will say this. I don't want to prognosticate on the Democratic side, so I'm not going to do that. But I will say that Election Day 2016 was a very bad night for Bill de Blasio. And it was actually a pretty bad night for Andrew Cuomo in the end, although you might think of 2020 potentially gives him an opportunity. But it was a very bad night for New York Democrats altogether. They expected the Hillary surge, and everybody was looking forward to this huge Hillary surge that you would have, where they would carry the state Senate, they would carry congressional seats. They were talking about taking 6 state Senate seats. They were talking about taking 4, 5, 6, or 7 congressional seats from the Republicans. That there was going to be this big wave election in New York and sweep all the Republicans out. What we're looking at now is in the state Senate that the Republicans will retain control, which makes Bill de Blasio's life an absolute nightmare. It actually, depending on how you look at things, how cynical you want to be, it's that we don't know what that does vis-a-vis Andrew Cuomo. But you're also looking at very significant margins, aside from one seat, Steve Israel's seat, that belonged to a Democrat, right, where the Republicans failed to win, where they possibly had a chance. Lee Zeldin won, John Faso won, Tom Reed won, Elise Stefanik won, John Katko won, Claudia Tenney won. Every single that was known as a competitive race here in New York State that a Republican congressman was supposed to lose, they won.
At the end, though, the 2017 municipal elections are about the Democratic Party, because there is no real Republican. There's no real path for a Republican victory. I know we say that every year, and it's true that there was a period of 20 years where ostensibly a Republican controlled it. But the last, Michael Bloomberg was as Republican as he wished to be. And once he won 01 under 2001, right, under very different circumstances, right, 05 and 09 were different races.
And
it was an incumbency.
And by the way,
let me just point out,
we worked against each other.
The reason I bring that up is because it's a lot different situation when you're the mayor of New York City and you have a relationship with the president, a good relationship with the president, right, and you have a relationship with Albany. And right, Bill de Blasio has neither of
those. But the question
is,
how does that translate into an effect in a Democratic primary?
That's something I'll leave to the Democratic political consultants. What I'm telling you is, this will be a year of bad headlines in many ways for Bill de Blasio, not just
internally, but
vis-a-vis Albany and vis-a-vis Washington. Bill de Blasio could not have played the presidential race any worse than he did. I mean, it's inexplicable, actually. And for somebody who's such a seasoned politician or a seasoned political pro to have played it this badly. He alienated Hillary Clinton. He alienated the left wing by then endorsing Hillary Clinton. So he alienated them. He certainly went after Donald Trump in a very big way. And then that ends up losing. I mean, every single which way. Because of the federal investigations, he was kind of forced out of raising money for the Democratic State Senate. And they fell short anyway. So his arch enemies with the Republicans of the State Senate are still empowered and probably more emboldened to hurt Bill de Blasio in every which way they can.
Right. And I would actually say that even as a Democrat, I'll say that some of the things that Republican state senators do are not just to vehemently oppose him, but they are, in some respects, good policy choices. You know, when they don't want to give him mayoral control, a lot of that has to do with the fact that they don't like him, but a lot of that has to do with the fact that they don't trust him. And there are Republicans in the Senate who say, look, you know, you send us the bill for a lot of what you depend on for your public schools, and we think you're a bad mayor who's doing a bad job. We're willing to give you another year, but we're not willing to enshrine it. And when he says, well, you gave Mike Bloomberg 7 years, yeah, we trusted Mike Bloomberg. We don't trust you. And, you know, so he's got to go back to Albany, January, February, March, and beg again. You know, in the middle of his primary very hostile environment with a governor who does not like him personally and does not support him politically and is not in agreement with him on policy, to ask for control of a school system that he ostensibly runs.
In the remaining few minutes, we didn't touch on who on the Republican side will be challenging de Blasio.
It almost doesn't matter. I say that as a Democrat, but
right.
Were to come back, he is not a factor, and he may be the strongest candidate. So, you know, Eric Ulrich, councilman from Queens, fine public servant, very, very bright, arms around policy in a very strong way. But, you know, again, as I said, with regard to Democratic candidates running, competing in the city's campaign finance system is extremely, extremely difficult. Joe Loda was a seasoned politician, a bright guy, a nice person.
Probably the most qualified guy ever to run.
Certainly on the Republican side and in many respects on the Democratic side. This guy had literally run the city of New York for a good number of years, but couldn't make traction.
Few weeks ago, Joe Loda was a guest on the show. And he attributed it, and he's right, is, you know, technically a fourth term for a Republican. Right. That's like.
Well, it goes back to what I said about the presidential race.
Exactly.
Is that the parties flip.
So here,
with the exception of Bloomberg succeeding Giuliani in a very unique post 9/11 set of circumstances, you don't see, you know, once the idea of we have to elect a Republican because the Democrats have broken New York City, once that's passed and that's no longer an issue and it's off the table because, you know, after 12 years of Mike Bloomberg, you can't really say Democrats broke New York City anymore because it's not broken. And so Democrats come in and they say, well, we're taking it. Now the question is going to become after 4 years or three point eight years of Bill de Blasio, is there going to be a Republican who's going to be able to get up and with a straight face say the Democrats have broken New York City? Bill de Blasio will have broken New York City in many respects, but is it so broken by the time a Republican stands up next November, a year from now, that he'll be able to make the case to get more votes
than
Bill de Blasio?
Believe it or not, we're almost completely out of time. And the last, I guess I'll give 30 seconds to each of you. Any final thoughts? I know it's that quick, but we're out of time.
I got a closing statement.
A closing statement.
Against the Democrat. Go.
I'm kind of flummoxed here because, you know, there's no question on the table. But I would say is that I agree with Common. It's extraordinarily difficult for any Republican to come in. Yes, you know, you can have the wealthy Republican. I think really what it is a protest vote. That's always been the Republican message to go ahead is that the protests. Things are not going well, and we need reform. Things need reform. Things need to be fixed. Can you do that? Yeah, there has to be enough pockets in the city. But the city has also changed. It continues to change over and over. And the Republican Party in New York City in general is actually five different parties in five different boroughs and is not organized and frequently does not cooperate with each other. So they have a very difficult time fielding that. But the Republican Party in the state overall is in much better shape today than they were a week ago.
In the city, the Republican Party has been losing seats. I mean, I remember a time when they had 7 seats in the city council. Right. That's not 100 years ago. That's only about 20 years ago.
And now there are 3.
And now there are 3. And, you know, 2 of them are on Staten Island, where a Democrat really has to, a Republican really has to decide to kill himself in order to lose an election. So, you know, you're talking about a near impossible feat. And I'm not saying that as somebody who didn't vote for Rudy. I voted for Mike Bloomberg once. You know, there are times when a Democrat looks at the Republican and the Democrat and says Republican needs to win this one. But I will say this. There's an old line. You can't beat someone with no one. There is no real Republican out there who's able right now, as I see it, to make the case to being able to get more votes than a Bill de Blasio on the ticket next time. And if Bill de Blasio has a challenge and loses his party's primary or gets into a runoff against a Ruben Diaz Jr., against a Scott Stringer, against a possibly Hakeem Jeffries, then certainly I don't see a Republican being able to beat them.
Michael Kelman, thank you so much.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. What an amazing program. In case you're just tuning in for the tail end, all I can tell you is that the good news is it will be up on WABC Biz Radio in a couple of days. Stay tuned for the John Batchelor Show up next. And tune in again next Sunday evening for another edition of Mind Your Business right here on 77 WABC.
77 WABC Radio presents Mind Your Business, hosted by founder and president of Bottom Line Marketing Group, Yitzhak Safliff. Mind Your Business focuses on business and marketing strategies for success. Tune in every Sunday night from 11 until 12 for this intriguing weekly radio show that's chock full of business insights and marketing strategies that will help you get ahead of the game. Host Yitzhak Safliff has been producing pioneering and creative marketing work for over 2 decades. He leads a team of marketing experts who help their clients build their brands and grow their businesses. Now, he and his guests offer their business and marketing expertise to you every Sunday night from 11 until midnight on Mind Your Business.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.